Handsworth Reel 4.
Mm.
When you were on these wiring operations,
Mm.
wire mending
Mm.
operations, what were the sort of hazards and problems that you faced?
Well, if he was still shelling, if a break was caused by shell fire, because they weren't always that, sometimes they were caused by transport going up the line, you see, when we're catching them and pulling them down. Because sometimes you had to have a pole crossing over a hard road, you couldn't dig underneath, you had to have a pole crossing, of course, that was always a risk. But if he was still shelling, well, my usual procedure was to draw in the line to a safe distance, then splice a piece onto it.
What do you mean, drawing the line? What would you be doing exactly?
Well,
A bit more
I'd
detail.
followed the line so far, you see, until I got where he was shelling. Well, it's no good going in there. I'm going to get hit and the line's going to get broke again, so I might as well pull it clear. And then splice a piece onto it, take it, say, 50 yards further round, and find the other end of the wire, and then join up like that, so to leave it clear. Which was far better than, I mean, I lost men, inexperienced men, through that, because they'd go in and mend a line, and, well, I went up one night from, when we were at, who would you call it? I was sent for, I wasn't on duty, and the old man rang through for me to go up and. Two men had gone out on the line at one at a time, because we couldn't send two men. We had less than 20 men, and he should have had 31. We're sending one at a time. And neither of them had been heard of. Would I go up and see what was happening? Because this was the line to the OP, and there was something coming off in the morning at about 6 o'clock. So I went up. It's not a very nice thought. You go, you've two of your men have not been heard of for an hour or more. You wonder what's happened to them. Well, one was dead and the other one was unconscious, wounded. First thing is to get the line through, you see. Dead man, I could do nothing for him. The other fellow was unconscious, so there you are. I got the line through, you see, and then told him to send a stretcher bearer up, you see, and take this wounded man down. And that's it. I don't know whether he recovered or not. I've no idea. He went down to dressing station. That's the last I heard of him. But you see, if they'd done as I'd done, I mended that line. By taking it further on, I didn't get hit, and the shelling was still going on.
Leaving operational activities for the moment, I'd be interested to have some idea of what life was like in an artillery battery. You know, the most sort of general aspects of life. What you did when you weren't working. How the life in an artillery battery was different, say, from the infantry soldier's life, because you'd be farther back and there obviously would be differences.
Well, the main amusement, I think, was playing cards, usually a nap or a pontoon, that sort of thing. I'd have the Methodist upbringing and I wouldn't gamble. And sometimes, to make up the number, they persuaded me to play. And it was a sort of no annexations, no indemnities, they called it. If I won, I didn't draw any winnings. And if I lost, I didn't pay out. But there was one where I trumped a chap's ace, the last one. He was rather annoyed. He got an up-handy thought. And I spoilt it like that. We used to have a bit of music at times. I have a whistle in there, you know. I took it out with me when I came on leave. I used to entertain them like that. And sometimes you'd have a mouth organ or anything like that, you know. But
Did you have any of your own songs? You know, songs about the battery or songs about the artillery?
no, not, there was the usual popular songs, you know, "Marry Myself and My Mum," "I Want to Go Home," and all sorts of that, you know. But those are only on marching when you were marching. But normally you just went about your job, and by the time you'd finish your job, all you wanted to do was get your head down and have a rest, because when you're working, say, 16 hours on and 8 hours off, and then having to do line mending in your off-duty time or anything like that, when you haven't much time for any recreation.
Tell me a bit about the living conditions with the battery. You know, were you under
Well,
canvas or in
no,
trenches
no,
or
no,
what?
no. We were generally dug in somewhere, you see, in a bunker or anything like that. Occasionally, in summertime, you're out in the open. Before the Somme battle, we had one place we were out in the open. I remember a most unusual thing there. We laid just behind, there was a bank, it's about 2 feet high, just was a bit of shelter from the morning breeze, you know, and there was very, very heavy dew in the morning, very heavy dew. This was evening, just, you know, about the sun was going down. And suddenly there was a swarm of huge beetles, they were, things about an inch long. And this lot of boats, I should say, 2 feet thick, was coming from the east, from the enemy side, just above ground level, for, I should say, oh, half an hour or more. What they were, or where they'd come from, where they're going to, I just don't know, but you could hit that stream like that with a flagpole and knock half a dozen down. They never deviated. We moved at Finnish because these damn things, they weren't moving. We moved a few yards out of the side, and there was this stream of huge beetles going across like that.
Now, I have a sort of mental picture of artillery batteries, because they were a good deal farther behind the front line, mm-hmm. of conditions being, the physical conditions of living being somewhat more pleasant than those under which,
probably,
say, the infantry had to live.
Probably better,
I wondered to what extent you managed to make your battery site sort of comfortable for living, whether there were any particular ways you adapted the area for your own comforts.
Well, we moved about quite a bit, so you never had any permanent home, you see. If you were sometimes in near a village, or even if it was a ruined village, you made some sort of use of the remnants of the village, you see, by, say, building lean-tos against the remains of a wall, anything like that. Any timber, anything you could scrounge, such as that, you see, and then put a ground sheet over it, things like that. But before the Somme battle, we were dug into this chalk. It took a long while digging that lot, and we moved off. After the first day, we moved up to Carnoy from there. We never dug in like that anymore. We're out in the... you know where I showed you that picture? That's in Carnoy Valley.
Yeah. Did you have your own kitchens with the battery?
Oh, yes.
How did you do for food?
Stew. That's all we ever had, stew in Dixies.
Do you mean all you ate every day, 7 days a week, was stew?
Excepting you had rations, these McConachies they were called. That was a 16-ounce tin, which had supposed to have 10 ounces of meat, and 4 ounces of potato and 2 ounces of other vegetable like that. And it was a flat tin. You could heat that up, puncture a hole in it, you see, otherwise it would burst, and heat it up on a fire, anything like that, you see. But those were few and far between. Mostly, the cooks got up this frozen meat, you see, that sort of stuff, and cut it up and made a stew in these dixies. And you went with your dixie and got so much stew ladled out. Morning breakfast was 2 slices of bread with a bacon in between. And if you're lucky, the cook would dip it in the grease for you, see? And one clapped on top of the other like that with so much bacon. That was your breakfast. Mm-hmm. And for tea, you would say corned beef or sardines or anything like that. But mostly bread and jam, you see. Mm. Supper there wasn't any, unless you managed to save any of your own rations, you see. And because we used to get stuff sent out from home as well, you know.
On the whole, did you do fairly well for food?
Except when there's any battle on. Mm. The rations came up pretty regularly, oh yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But the signallers were sometimes at a disadvantage under, say, real action conditions, because you were out on your own, and you couldn't get back to the battle for any rations.
Mm. Now, you were serving on the Somme front when you first went over to France. What were the main kinds of operations that you were involved in as a battery?
Usually counter-battery work and shelling roads to disrupt transport.
Mm. Okay, tell me about counter-battery work.
Well, the idea was to knock out an enemy battery to stop him shelling your infantry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what kind of equipment did you use for this purpose, and how did you actually do it?
Well, as I said before, we used to find them by three positions like that, you see.
Yeah, I see.
And also by aerial observation with balloons, and sometimes with planes going over in the early morning, you see, because they couldn't go over much in the daytime in the Somme, because that time Jerry had the master of the air, you see.
Yeah. Tell me about the air shoots. Were they successful, or did they have any problems?
They were not very successful at first, because the only means of communication with the plane was with there was no wireless. We had to fire a very light pistol, and we had a code of signals, red, green, and white.
What did that mean?
Well, according to the order in which you got them, you could have, say, three reds, three greens, three whites. You see, or red, green, red, green, green, white, green. That sort of thing. You see, we had a code which all they meant, and it was sort of over or short, right or left, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept doing that until you got someone near the target. And our own means of communication with him was with long white strips about 12 foot by 1 foot, which was to lay out on the grass.
Yeah.
The major didn't like it. He used to send us about a quarter of a mile away at least. Then we'd have a telephone line to the battery.
Let's concentrate a bit on the preparations for the Somme battle in 1916. Mm. First of all, can you give me some idea of the scale of the artillery preparation for that battle?
As far as
your battery was concerned, tell me what you remember about that.
For our four guns, we accumulated 5,000 rounds of ammunition in holes and pits and anything. We dug some pits, but we'd strewn about within the radius of 100 yards behind the battery, you see, so as not to risk too much being hit at once in case the enemy did start shelling around there. And by the end of the first week, that we started bombarding a week before, you see, and by the end of that week, we'd used up all that ammunition, plus what had been brought up as well. Mm.
Could you tell me a bit more about the details of the preparations? For example, you know, how would you bring up the ammo?
It was brought up in wagons to the nearest point on the road, and then we had to carry it from there by hand, you know, after dark, down to wherever pitch we're putting it in, you see.
How'd you carry a shell?
You slung two shells together with a stick between the slings and slung them over your shoulder. If you carried a single shell by itself, where they weren't in slings, sometimes they came up loose, and we had to carry them singly then. They were very, very hard on your shoulder, a 60-pounder shell, so we used to put a folded sandbag under your braces, so it's like a shoulder pad, otherwise your shoulder was very sore by the end of the spell. Mm-hmm. And the cartridge boxes, there were 10 in a box. Each cartridge weighs 9 pounds, 7 ounces, plus the box, so you'd used to nearly 100 weights altogether, the metal-lined box. And there were wire handles towards the top on each side at such a length that as you walked, the bottom edge of the box was catching on your ankle. Devilish thing. So we used to finally get two chaps to lift it on your shoulder like that and hold it, sling it, and carry it on your shoulder, on your back, you see, down there, and then drop them off.
Mm. Now, as you were stockpiling this ammo in preparation for the Somme battle, how did you deal with the problem of storing so much of it?
Put it in these holes, all the way around.
Okay.
Some was at the roadside. We left it at the roadside. You have to bring it down other nights, you see.
Mm-hmm. Would you, on arriving at a new site for your gun, would you dig the gun in? To what extent would you dig the gun in?
Dependent on what sort of cover you had. Normally, you didn't dig them in. Only the trail was dug in. So the spade of the gun had something solid to butt against, you see. Also, you dug the trail in so as to get a greater elevation, you see. Normally, your range was 13,500, and that was about with a 2 CRH shell, that was 2-calibre radius head. Do you follow what I mean? The curvature on the nose of the shell was equivalent to a circle of 2 calibres, in other words, 10-inch, you see. Mm-hmm. Well, then we got some later shells, which are 8 CRH, which they call them Roses Cordials. They were...
Roses what?
Roses Cordials. You know those lime juice cordial bottles?
Oh, yeah.
Like that. And the taper was very much steeper. And if we dug in so that we could get 35 degrees elevation, we could reach 15,000 yards with those, but they were not as accurate as the other shells at a shorter range.
Mm. Well, there were different techniques then for using the different kinds of ammunition you'd be firing.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Tell me what kind of techniques you'd use for what kind of ammunition. I mean, take common shell, for example. What was common shell and how would you...
Well, common shell was used for knocking down masonry, anything like that. I mean, the week before the Somme battle started, the night before it actually started, the last thing we did was to knock down Mamet's church and Waterloo chimney. By means of common shell. You range with shrapnel first, which gives you a white smoke, you see, easily visible. Well, that was customary, you'd range with shrapnel. And then you use common shell. While you're watching through glasses, it's just like a hammer blow. The striking force was about 40 tons. And you just saw the whole corner of the church simply knocked out. And, we were not sure whether the Jerrys, if there were any up top, whether they'd got down in time before we brought the tower down. Because the moment... that shot's fired, you see, the gun fired immediately before the shell arrives at its destination. Mm. They're reloading that gun. Mm.
From the point of view of the gun crew, what was the differences in their method between, say, firing common shell and firing shrapnel?
Well, common shell has no fuse. It's just a solid lump of steel. The shrapnel shell, the fuse has to be set according to what height you want it to burst or what your range is, you see. the fuse has a ring marked out in tenths of a second, and according to your time of flight, you try to make that shrapnel shell burst just nicely above ground level, because a shrapnel shell consists of, it's like a shotgun really. The nose of the shell is spigoted into the body of the shell and is held by either lead or little wooden rivets. In the bottom, there's a bursting charge. There's a cast iron plate above that. There's a rod goes right through the shell, a hollow tube, and from the fuse, there's a double fuse in the shrapnel shell. There's a time fuse and a percussion fuse. And the flash from that goes down into the base, ignites the bursting charge. The iron plate pushes the bullets up and forces the nose of the shell off, and then the bullets are all sprayed out of the shell. Like that. Well, if the shell hits the ground first, it's useless.
Yeah.
You did have a percussion fuse, yeah. But all that happens is that the bullets are just driven in the ground. I mean, I've had shrapnel shell burst alongside me and no damage at all, practically gone in the ground.
I know one of the great problems for artillery in 1914-15 was quality of the ammunition was very low. What was it like in 16 when you went
in
over?
In 16, we were having American ammunition and some of the fuses was very bad. Because before then we used to get premature bursts quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the fuse would ignite, would detonate the shell just outside the gun muzzle, maybe 100 yards, you see.
That could be a bit hazardous for the gun crew.
I've never heard anybody get hurt because it's going forward, you see. But I mean, you're wasting your time when a shell bursts with it before it's done 100 yards.
Mm. Was the ammunition faulty in any other ways?
No.
Any other problems you had?
No. Later on, when you're getting enough British ammunition, we didn't have it again. But there again, you get different fuses. The original fuses was the 44 for HE. That has a fifth of a second delay, you see. So it goes in the ground. Blowing up the enemy's wire to uproot it, sort of thing. The shrapnels had the fuse was number 88. Well, then later on we got the 106 fuse. That was a shrapnel fuse, but it was to burst on ricochet, you see, up to about 9,000 yards, a 60-pounder lands on its shoulder.